So, Jacob, say there's a town.
Okay.
This
I'm
town.
visualizing it. I'm rotating it in my mind.
Give yourself like a word picture, right? This town is, the weather's perfect, right? The people are all nice. There's generally like plenty. Nobody's going hungry. Nobody's going thirsty. As far as entertainment goes, every other person plays an instrument. Everybody who has the inclination pursues some form of art. And
I
yeah,
mean,
every.
surely a town can't be this perfect. Surely it must have some dark secret.
Exactly. Everybody is provided for in this place, but yeah, there has to be a catch, right? Well, okay. Say that this town, in order for all this to come about, there has to be a kid in some basement somewhere, just starving and beaten and just like brutalized in every form or fashion possible.
Okay.
I mean,
That
that's
sounds bad. That
it
sounds
does.
something you shouldn't do.
Counterpoint.
Okay.
What if that kid fucking sucks?
Like it's like one of those like Gen Alpha like kids that's like talking about Skibidi Toilet all the time. Like it's one of
Yeah,
those kids.
like you open up the door to his dungeon and he is like, man, this place isn't so Skibidi Sigma, you know what I mean?
Yeah, he's like, it's not Skibidi Sigma. I don't gotta, this place hasn't got the Riz, you know. I gotta throw back my yacht for the Riz. Like what
Chat,
if,
is this room even real?
yeah, see, yeah, chat, is this story about utilitarianism? Yeah. What if that happened? Or I'll raise you another thing though. What if it's what if the baby is baby Jesus? And I know you say, oh, well, that's terrible. Baby Jesus is so sweet. But I'm just saying, if you're a Christian or Christian adjacent, you've basically made that agreement just by virtue of being a Christian. So
Also, like, if anybody could take it, Jesus could, right?
Jesus could and did. Essentially, that's kind of the central premise. Would be crazy if someone had written that story and proposed that hundreds of years before Ursula K. Le Guin did.
It'll probably never catch on.
Maybe not.
Listening to Socialist Shelf Radio.
Welcome to the Socialist Shelf. Today, we will be talking about kids that suck. That's right, we're taking a hardcore pro Omelis stance, critical support to the Omelis Socialist Republic.
We are hardcore anti-natalists here at the Socialist Shelf.
Yeah. O'Melian, braised Marxism, Leninism, O'Melianism. I don't know.
We are ordinarily not utopians, but it depends on the utopia, right?
Right. Well, if the utopia rocks, then like, yeah, we can have a conversation about it. Today we are talking about Ursula K. Le Guin, The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelis, a short story from the collection The Wind's 12 Quarters, published in 1980.
I
And this is
mean, that
really
sounds,
short.
I mean, that sounds great, right? But I mean, 12 quarters, that's like $3 in this economy.
In this economy, that's
I'm
The
just
Wind's
saying.
12 Quarters. Yeah, no, I don't know. It's hard to say, but in Omelis, it can get you quite a lot, probably.
Oh, yeah.
But we are just at the top. Typically, we'll go into an author. We'll get into a deep dive. And Ursula K. Le Guin certainly deserves that deep dive. But in truth, I do not think this story and this time is the moment for such a deep dive. We really want to get into a full novel of Le Guin's, either The Dispossessed or The Left Hand of Darkness, to really talk about her as an artist in fullness. She's phenomenal, really amazing, just a lot there, just a real master of speculative fiction. And I think it would be this would be a limited framework with which to talk about it, but we also frankly wanted to do this episode. Frankly, time wise, it was nice to do a story that's 5 pages long.
Yeah.
It is no disrespect to Ursula K. Le Guin that we will not be doing a full deep dive, a full bio on her today, but I think the story stands alone in its own type of way, and frankly, stands apart from a lot of the work that she did, and is just not the greatest framework through which to investigate her. I'm kind of more interested in the story in this podcast, or the frame of this episode. The story is sort of a standalone project, and also kind of the cultural resonance it's had. Though, of course, I did, like, you know, look into her quotes and thoughts on the work itself. That makes sense, Joss?
Absolutely, and I'm glad one of us did.
Okay, solid, solid.
I am going into this very, 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 very inexperienced with Le Guin. My sister is the big Le Guin head in the family. I have never read a word she's written until now.
Yeah, and I'll say, and I'm not the biggest expert, but as someone who's read some Le Guin, this is quite different than her typical fare. I think the ones who walk away from Amelis is very singular. It seems very much like she had a very particular brainworm that was, like, sort of exercised with this story. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason that this is a story that, like, a lot of people know, and even if they don't know it, they kind of, like, know the reference to it. Like, it is, like, sort of a cultural standing point. I mean, this thing has been referenced to all hell. Like, BTS has, like, a music video about this short story. Like,
was Ursula K. Le Guin the original Stan?
No, but I think they stan her. Like, it's like it's like the guy you stan stans her. Like, it's a kind of a power ranking of Stan. But yeah, the 2017 music video, the song Spring Day, they even have like a hotel. It says, like, welcome to Amelis and stuff like that.
Is there one K-pop fan somewhere that's in horrible, like, brutal, like, torture conditions so that BTS can have their career?
I mean, like, I think that's the South Korean working class is the not to spoil the story here, but yeah, there's a lot of references to this. I mean, there's been, like, this story has inspired quite a lot of response stories. I mean, like, apparently the Outsider from the Dishonored video games was, like, inspired by this story, like, the concept of, like, the dark being that's, like, at the like edge of society. I don't know, I've not played Dishonored video games, so I'm like
an edge lord, you might say.
Yeah, something like that. An edge lord, the lord of the edge.
I cosplayed him at one point because my girlfriend at the time was a considerably more impressive Emily Caldwin. But I don't know much about the character himself.
Apparently it's based on the child from this story in concept, like the idea of, like, and I'm speaking as deeply unknowledgeable about the series, but apparently Ricardo Bear and Harvey Smith took the idea of, like, all the pain and badness of a society being projected onto another being, and kind of, like, and the misery thereof, and kind of had this concept of, like, well, actually that creature could be quite powerful. You know, another way, this story has inspired a lot of people who are thinking about it. The film Us was also, Jordan Peele's Us, also partially inspired by this. Though I think it also probably took from some Octavia Butler as well. There's some real speech sounds vibes going on in there.
It feels very butlery.
Yeah. Guy who's only read speech sounds, getting a lot of speech sounds vibes from this.
If you launch a holy war based on Octavia Butler's work, would that be the Butlerian Jihad?
It would be correct regardless. I think it would be an Earthseed style Butlerian Jihad.
Yes. Yes. Uncritical support for the Earthseed Jihad.
Fuck yeah. But this story itself, it's awesome. It was nominated for Locus Award for Best Short Fiction and won the Hugo Award for Best Short Story. Also, it's worth noting that that this story, I said it was published in 1980, and that is true, but it was originally published in 1973. So I don't know if I'm going to edit that or if you're just getting the correct answer here, but it was published, like, it was published in a book in 1980. It was published like just like in an anthology in 1973. So apologies for getting that wrong. I probably
happy 50th anniversary.
Yes, exactly right. And it still applies. This is a short story that, like, I'll say again, it's so short. Like, go and read it. Like, pause the podcast, read it, come back. Like, it's really short. Like, you will read it in a few minutes. It's very quick. I even thought about, like, reading it all out loud. It would be a little long to read all out loud. Like, you might get a little tired of our voice if we read it all, but, like, it's quite short. But it leaves a lot to think about. The general premise, summarized very simply, is what if there was a perfect town? And I mean a really perfect town. And I mean a really, really perfect town. Like, it really wants to hammer that home. But in the basement, way beneath the city, there was one miserable, horrible, starving, just made wretched child who must suffer for the city to continue in its perfection. And what would that cause? And it's the ones who walk away from malice, because some people see it and they just walk away. And there's more specificity than that, but that is, like, there are no characters in the sense of no named characters. There are no real, there's very little in the way of specific scenes, specific interactions. There's in dialogue and all that. It's just basically posing this question. It's asking you about utilitarianism. It's asking you about exploitation. It is a trolley problem made poetic, to put it simply.
Yeah, with the kid on one track and presumably the whole town on the other track, and if you throw the switch, you know, you pick one, right? Yeah, I mean, it's and you know, worth noting, it's never, I mean, the mechanics of it, right, the how of the kid's suffering being critical to the prosperity of the town is, of course, never explained, right? Le Guin's point here is to ask you, okay, here is this irreconcilable contradiction. It can't be solved. It can't be reformed, right? Do you stick with it? Or, indeed, do you walk away?
Yeah, and it really does want you to, like, it spends the first half really selling that Amelis rules. I mean, it's talking about joyous. How is one to tell about joy? How describe the citizens of Omelis? They were not simple folk, you see, though they were happy. But we do not say the words of cheer much anymore. All smiles have become archaic. Given a description such as this one tends to make certain assumptions. Given a description such as this one tends to look next for the king, mounted on a splendid stallion and surrounded by his noble knights, or perhaps a golden litter borne by great muscled slaves. But there was no king. They did not use swords or keep slaves. They were not barbarians. I do not know the rules and laws of their society, but I suspect that they were singularly few, as they did without monarchy and slavery. So they also got on without the stock exchange, the advertisement, the secret police, and the bomb. Yet I repeat that these were not simple folks, not dulcet shepherds, noble savages, bland utopians. They were not less complex than us. And it goes on like this. It really wants to sell you on this utopia and also to really examine it from all angles. And it is given in this voice, not from the inside, but from the outside, a author who is sitting next to you, like talking like a teacher, describing. Mm-hmm. The author at a certain point is even like, you know what? Imagine what you want to. What's your perfect society? That's Omelis. Is there like hella sex happening? There's hella sex happening. Is there drugs? There's drugs. The women and men and everything in between that are going out and from these temples to be the priesthood of sex. What, you don't like temples? Okay, there's no temples. Don't worry about it. Do you like technology? It's got texture. Oh, you don't like technology. Oh no, Amelis, they're absolutely going back to the land. Whatever you want, reader, whatever you want. It really wants to nail that home.
And the constant in any of these visions of this society, right, is It's motion, right? There is always something happening. There are always beautiful sounds to listen to, beautiful sights to see. The way it starts here, with a clamor of bells that set the swallows soaring, the festival of summer came to the city Omelas, bright towered by the sea. The ringing of the boats in harbor sparkled with flags, in the streets between houses with red roofs and painted walls, between old moss-grown gardens and under avenues of trees, past great parks and public buildings, processions moved. You know, it's motion. It is everywhere something to see, and it is motion that unites people in a way that immediately gets us looking for a catch, right? And Le Guin says it herself in the paragraph that you're showing us here, right? We are accustomed to happiness despite struggle, right? So when we see this happiness, naturally we're like, okay, what's the catch? What's going on? What hierarchy is there? What inequality is there to keep people in line or to keep people hustling, right? There's none. There's none. Nothing economic, nothing monarchical, nothing. I mean, what she says about religion is, what was it? Religion? Yeah, religion, yes. Clergy, no. That's a direct quote. So it's a shared non-hierarchical spirituality. It's a shared, I wouldn't even say necessarily a goal, right? These people coexist in a way that they've developed to a point where they can perfectly coexist. Yeah, you know, they have figured out coexistence. Whence, of course, the assertion from Le Guin that these are not simple people. You know, presumably there was a long and arduous path to get here that, you know, just as we will see, happened to result in one person missing out on all this cool stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, like, it does a great job really, really selling you on the utopia, too. Like, we're describing it, but, like, I mean, it says something like, Omelas sounds in my words like a city in a fairy tale long ago and far away once upon a time. Perhaps it would be best if you imagine it as your own fancy bids, assuming it will rise to the occasion, for certainly I cannot suit you all. For instance, how about technology? I think there would be no cars or helicopters in and above the streets. This follows from the fact that the people of Omelas are happy people. Little joke there. Happiness is based on a just discrimination of what is necessary, what is neither necessary nor destructive, and what is destructive. In the middle category, however, that of the unnecessary but undestructive, that of comfort, luxury, exuberance, etc., they could perfectly well have central heating, subway trains, washing machines, and all kinds of marvelous devices not yet invented here. Floating light sources, fuelless power, a cure for the common cold. Or they could have none of that. It doesn't matter. As you like it. It really wants you to, like, believe, you know, it wants you to, and it will keep on telling you, I know, like, you don't believe it. I know it seems fake, you know, and it gets into the parts talking about, like, hey, maybe Omelas strikes some of you as goody-goody. Well, if it pleases you, add an orgy. If an orgy would help, don't hesitate, it said. Like, it's very funny. Yeah, always, of course. It says, surely the beautiful nudes can just wander about offering themselves like divine souffles to the hunger divine of the needy souffles. And the rapture of the flesh. It's very funny.
There are turns of phrase in Le Guin's prose here that they really hook me, right, in terms of what they offer for world building. Like the she pontificates here in the second paragraph, the horse being the only animal who has adopted our ceremonies as his own. Like, there's an interesting intersection here between companion and beast of burden, right?
Yeah.
Our relationship to that animal, you know, it's foundational to our civilization. It's foundational to this civilization, certainly. And it's more thoroughly examined than, you know, the city's relationship to the other creature on whose burden hangs everything, you know?
Notably, there's no bit in the horse's bridle in Omelas either. It makes that point. The horse can be led very simply. The horse does not have to be exploited.
Well, you know, without bits, right, we are all easily led.
That's true. The only people who are using, you know, bridles and saddles and things like that and leather implements in general in Omelas are presumably this priesthood of sex souffles walking around, grabbing people off the streets and doing as they will. Presumably there's plenty of that going on there. But we are left to imagine that. And reader, imagine as you will. We're not going to stop you
here. Must imagine Omelas sexy, yes.
One must imagine Omelas sexy. And yeah, it goes on. It has little moments. There is one moment that has like a very small scene, and it's for a very particular reason. It says, and this is talking about a parade, a child of 9 or 10 sits at the edge of the crowd alone, playing on a wooden flute. People pause to listen and they smile, but they do not speak to him, for he never ceases playing and never sees them. His dark eyes wholly wrapped in the sweet thing, magic of the tune. He finishes and slowly lowers his hands, holding the wooden flute. And it goes on. And it's notable because, like, it will introduce the child in a second. It will introduce the tortured child, and that, of course, stands in comparison to this unnamed but similarly aged happy child playing the music. And it'll later even say, and I'm sure we'll read the quote, that like parents are able to love their children more because they know about the immiserated child. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it is important to, you know, focus on the really wretched part of the city. And I want to read that quote as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you believe? Do you accept the festival, the city, the joy? No? Then let me describe one more thing. In a basement under one of the beautiful public buildings of Omelas, or perhaps in the cellar of one of its spacious private homes, there is a room. It has one locked door and no window. A little light seeps in dustily between the cracks in the boards, secondhand from a cobwebbed window somewhere across the cellar. In one corner of the little room, a couple of mops with stiff, clotted, foul-smelling heads stand near a rusty bucket. The floor is dirt, a little damp to the touch, as cellar dirt usually is. The room is about 3 paces long and 2 wide, a mere broom closet or disused tool room. In the room, a child is sitting. It could be a boy or a girl. It looks about 6, but actually is nearly 10. It is feeble-minded. Perhaps it was born defective, or perhaps it has become an imbecile through fear, malnutrition, and neglect. It picks its nose and occasionally fumbles vaguely with its toes or genitals as it sits hunched in the corner furthest from the bucket and the two mops. It is afraid of the mops. It finds them horrible. It shuts its eyes, but it knows the mops are still standing there, and the door is locked and nobody will come. The door is always locked and nobody ever comes, except that sometimes the child has no understanding of time or interval. Sometimes the door rattles terribly and opens and a person or several people are there. One of them may come in and kick the child to make it stand up. The others never come close, but peer in at it with frightened, disgusted eyes. The food bowl and the water jug are hastily filled and the door is locked and the eyes disappear. The people at the door never say anything, but the child, who has not always lived in the tool room and can remember sunlight and its mother's voice, sometimes speaks. "I will be good," it says. "Please let me out. I will be good." They never answer. The child used to scream for help at night and cry a good deal, but now it only makes a kind of whining, "ee-ha, ee-ha," and it speaks less and less often. It is so thin, there are no calves to its legs. Its belly protrudes. It lives on a half bowl of cornmeal and grease a day. It is naked. Its buttocks and thighs are a mass of festered sores as it sits in its own excrement continually. They all know it is there, the people of Omelas. Some of them have come to see it. Others are content merely to know it is there. They all know that it has to be there. Some of them understand why, and some do not. But they all understand that their happiness, the beauty of their city, the tenderness of their friendships, the health of their children, the wisdom of their scholars, the skill of their makers, even the abundance of their harvest and the kindly weathers of their skies depend wholly on the child's abominable misery. So that sucks.
Yeah. Yeah. It's as we've said, as we've alluded to, it is a scene of just the most abject wretchedness you can possibly imagine, you know, stagnance. And, you know, in contrast to the city constantly in motion, just the absolute stagnance, just the bare minimum of any kind of motion, any kind of action to let you know that this child is in fact living. There's a bit starting at the bottom of the first page where she says, where Le Guin says, you know, the trouble is that we have a bad habit and courage about pedants and sophisticates considering happiness as something rather stupid. Only pain is intellectual, only evil interesting. This is the treason of the artist, a refusal to admit the banality of evil and the terrible boredom of pain. If you can't lick them, join them. If it hurts, repeat it. But to praise despair is mask to condemn delight, to embrace violence is to lose hold of everything else. All of I bring this up to say, there is a tendency, I think, to fetishize struggle and hardship of itself, right? To say, okay, well, only suffering makes one interesting, intellectual. She heads that off here, I think, not just for us, but for the people in Omelas, right? To say, look, pain is not interesting. Struggle is not interesting. So if you look at this kid, it's just a fact. It's just a fact, right? Because to fetishize something is to introduce a dialectic whereby somebody is like, wait a minute, we should stop this, right? To fetishize something is to invite somebody to say, well, why are we fetishizing this in the first place? Here, it's just something to bear witness to and then move on.
That's right. And everyone has to be aware of it. It even says that sometimes they explain to children when they're around the same age as this kid. I also note that, like, for the light of Omelas, this room is dark. For the cleanliness and beauty, this room is dirty. For the wisdom, this child is ignorant. It's afraid of mops.
It is aware of punishments, presumably, you know, like it'll be good if you let it out, right?
Right. This kid is, you know, made wretched, but it knows beauty, which is, of course, the greater crime. Is it even a greater crime? Because this kid is aware of something beyond suffering. While they tell themselves that this kid, oh, well, he's just a brute. He's just a whatever. He doesn't get it. No, this kid actually does know what happiness is. This kid is aware enough to ask to leave. This kid is going more and more imbecile, as the term uses, is going more and more, you know, less cognizant, but it is a person who has had experiences and is capable of understanding in some capacity what is happening, mm-hmm. but not why, because, and it says most people, a lot of people don't understand why it's like this. And the story is not, this is not a hard sci-fi. Do not try to figure out why the kid's suffering makes Omelas go. It is, oh, the kid is hooked up to a machine that, no, it's not like that. This is a story. This is a metaphor. It's symbolic. Just let it be. Don't get like too Reddit brained about this, you know, please, listener. Because I knew if I looked up like Omelas Reddit, like why there would be, and yeah, there are people trying to figure out
Omelas Reddit.
Yeah.
What do you think Omelas Twitter would be like?
God damn it. Omelas Twitter is just like everyone being really nice and posting memes, and then everyone, and then this guy is like, will post a thread on while pointing out the child is ableist or whatever. Well, actually, pointing out, you know.
Actually, do you know what? Like, Le Guin, I think, does engage with it a little bit here as the story winds down.
Right? Yes.
You know, often the young people go home in tears or in a tearless rage when they have seen the child and face this terrible paradox. They may brood over it for weeks or years, you know, and, you know, it goes on and people eventually get used to it. Right. It is too degraded and imbecile to know any real joy. It has been afraid too long to ever be free of fear. You know, its habits are too uncouth for it to respond to humane treatments. People brood on this thing that they've seen for a while, and then they start coming out with rationalizations, right? And then the next really hideous part of the story for me, their tears at the bitter injustice dry when they begin to perceive the terrible justice of reality and to accept it. Yet as their tears and anger, their trying of their generosity and the acceptance of their helplessness, which are perhaps the true source of the splendor of their lives, there is no vapid, irresponsible happiness. They know that they, like the child, are not free. They know compassion. It is the existence of the child and their knowledge of its existence that makes possible the nobility of their architecture, the poignancy of their music, the profundity of their science. It is because of the child that they are so gentle with children. And that's the thing, right? When you rationalize this suffering away, right, and when you make art of it, when you fetishize suffering without struggle, that's what it leads to, right? It's this obsession with death. It's this, you know, masturbatory, like, it's this masturbatory pontification on the body of a starving child, which produces insipid music for insipid festivals.
It is interesting, like, you know, and you can imagine the old people being like, damn young people, so upset about the child. We've been dealing with the child. I'm going to start calling Gen Z, Gen C, because they care about the child so much. If you don't get that, if you don't get that reference, then thank God you're not as online as I am.
Yeah, consider yourself blessed.
Yeah. And but like ultimately, like these people are aware, and it's like they're like they feel they come to this understanding, like, actually, I'm a better person because I am aware of the suffering. Mm-hmm. I am a better person because I went and saw the child. A really good person goes and sees the child every month so they can feel extra bad about it. So they can, you know, have extra penitence, whatever. Mm-hmm. But they don't fix it, right? And notably, that as there are some who don't quite understand the story who are like, well, why don't they let the child out? Well, they can't. Amellis falls apart if you let the child out. That's not a false problem. Don't like over intellectualize this and say, well, there's no reason. No, like for some reason, Amellis will fall apart if you let the child out. The question is it worth it to have Amellis fall apart? Can the child even be saved? Mm-hmm. In this world, presumably not. But what can happen is you can leave Amellis.
Yes.
And I wanna read the very last part here. At times, one of the adolescent girls or boys who go see the child does not go home to weep or rage, does not in fact go home at all. Sometimes also a man or a woman, much older, falls silent for a day or two, then leaves home. These people go out into the street and walk down the street alone. They keep walking and walk straight out of the city of Amellis through one of the beautiful gates. They keep walking across the farmlands of Amellis. Each one goes alone, youth or girl, man or woman. Night falls, the traveler must pass down village streets between the houses with yellow lit windows and on out into the darkness of the fields. Each alone, they go west or north towards the mountains. They go on. They leave Amellis. They walk ahead into the darkness and they do not come back. The place they go towards is a place even less imaginable to most of us than the City of Happiness. I cannot describe it at all. It is possible that it does not exist, but they seem to know where they are going, the ones who walk away from Amellis. Le Guin does an actual roll credits here, ending the story on the you know, this really has been a Marvel Endgame.
And so there's this
what are we, some kind of Suicide Squad?
There's this post credit scene where Nick Fury goes to the kid and he's like, I want to talk to you about the Avengers Initiative.
Yeah. Yeah, what are we? Some kind of the ones who walk away from Amellis?
So, intellectually, many people know, I think, there's been books about it more recently as well. Many people know that child labor in the Congo provides a lot of the rare earth metals that make our cell phones and laptops and shit function. You know, there is a degree of suffering that is incomprehensible to many people that they may intellectually be aware of, right? But that they just kind of go through life and, there's nothing to be done about it on an individual level. And eventually that acceptance metastasizes to the collective level, right? Well, you know, I can't do anything about it. Nobody can do anything about it. It sucks, but, you know, it just kind of got to be that way. And that's the lie that people tell you, right? You know, suffering is not the natural state of those who suffer. The child has not always lived in that basement, right?
Right.
You know, the lie that, you know, some countries are developing, some are developed, you know, people have been fighting in this or that region of the world because fundamentally different ethnic groups or religions can't coexist, right? You know, no, there are countries and populations that have been actively plundered and de-developed. And, you know, people, in fact, can and historically have set aside their differences and struggled for better conditions. You know, there are material drivers of conflict and there are classes which profit therefrom and classes which do not, right? And you have to set that aside to continue living in Amellis, right? To continue enjoying this standard of living that, I mean, that's the thing, right? If you ask somebody to describe, okay, so why is it great to be an American? You know, why, what makes us exceptional? You know, you'll get a different answer from everybody, you know, as you would get a different answer about Amellis, right? Mm. You know, I mean, this is to my mind a text against the conservative, right? You know, not the reactionary who wants to restrict and rescind rights and resources, but, you know, somebody who believes things should continue or can only continue exactly in this current state. Mm.
And, you know, this is not a, it's not a new question, the idea of the scapegoat, you know, notably. And it is interesting that, like, you know, Le Guin pulls from other sources, and this is a question that has been asked a lot. You know, we mentioned the trolley problem, but I also like, she pulled this directly, like she got the idea from this straight from I believe William James, it's an essay if you read it, but it was a lecture called The Moral Philosopher and the Moral Light.
Mm-hmm.
It was like 1890s. But he got it from, and this is a name I always have trouble with, Dostoevsky. Did I get it? His book Brothers Karamazov, which is just basically saying that talking about the scapegoat as basically, I mean, he's just talking about Jesus in that book. But it all connects. But it is interesting, right? Like this idea that in this, like you were saying, in the story, in The Moral Philosopher and The Moral Life, in Dostoevsky, and what's in the Bible itself and all of it, there has to be a sacrifice. There has to be a scapegoat. There has to be, at least in our understanding, some sufferer for there to be something good. There has to be some exploitation. Notably, I mean, Le Guin spends a lot of this story saying, do you believe it? I bet you don't. Noel, do you believe it now? Do you accept it now? To quote William James, actually, from his speech, he said, if the hypothesis were offered us of a world which Messieurs Fourier and Bellamy and Morris's utopias should all be outdone, he's referring to just different, like, utopian socialists, basically. We'll probably read Bellamy's Looking Backwards at some point, actually. And millions kept permanently happy on the one simple condition that a certain lost soul on the far-off edge of things should lead a life of lonely torture. What, except a skeptical and independent sort of emotion, can it be which would make us immediately feel, even though an impulse arose within us, to clutch at the happiness so offered? How hideous a thing would be an enjoyment when deliberately accepted as the fruit of such a bargain? But it is a bargain that we see as societally and culturally and historically as necessary. The idea that there has to be this sacrifice, that there has to be this misery. But here's the trick. As Joss was saying, there is child slavery in the world. There is actual horrific exploitation on scales unimaginable to us. And it isn't a trick question. Removing that from the equation does actually make the thing topple. Like, the thing has to be, the society has to be fundamentally different. There are people who will write, you know, there have been, like Sean Vivier wrote a response story called The Ones Who Don't Walk Away, for instance. And that short story goes and is basically like, well, wouldn't it be great if we freed the child and it's actually privileged to walk away from a Melis? And if we freed the child, we could have a Melis for everybody. And it's like, and like, no offense, I'm not like trying to beef with Sean Vivier here from Daily Science Fiction. You know, don't at me, Sean, please. But, he doesn't listen to the pod, I'm sure. That would be nice if he did, but he misses the point. No, a Melis does collapse if you remove the child. In the same way, global capitalism does collapse if you remove child labor. The tech sector does collapse if you remove the cobalt mines from the Congo. Like, in the same way that, like, every system has collapsed in some capacity when you remove exploitative
precisely
labor.
Right. Precisely.
The South could not continue to exist as, like, it's like fucking half capitalist, half feudalist bullshit when you remove
slavery. Whence the argument that, you know, oh, you know, the kid is too degraded. He's too traumatized. You know,
right.
He's too ignorant to ignore, to enjoy the fruits of his, to enjoy the fruits of freedom. I mean, the precisely that same argument was levied to argue that slaves shouldn't be freed. Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which, and you know, if you're a thinking, feeling person, you know, the obvious response is, well, the point is to end that degradation.
Right. Right. And to, you know, speak to things that are currently happening. No, there can't be, say, I don't know, an Israel. If you remove the apartheid from the situation, it would fundamentally destroy the system. And that's fucking fine.
Yeah,
right. Like, that's what we should take away. We should walk away. That is the lesson.
Yes, you know, we will.
If there is to be one,
we will recall, and we should talk about the story in more depth on the show at some point. That the United States in Omar El-Khad's short story Riverbed, right, herds Muslims into camps, you know, for their own safety, right? And if you raise your voice against it, you're told, you know, directly in the story, you should know your place.
Mm-hmm. And it's notable, and it's a frustrating, like, it is, of course, an unsolvable quandary. And it's meant to be. I mean, it's being clever here, and it's pulling it off. And most authors, a lesser author writing the story, it would probably come off as too clever by half. But it works here because Le Guin's fucking good. She's a very good writer, which is why I want to, like, you know, give her more due to do like a more deep episode on her specifically. But this like conundrum of Amela specifically has been like a brainworm for people. I mean, you have a lot of response stories. I think I'll actually link Bloodknife Magazine, friend of the show, Kurt Schiller, wrote a great article on Amela and specifically like the response stories and stuff it's raised. I'll probably link that in the show notes, but it's like, it's just a thing that like, It gets at you, and it makes you think. It's like, obviously, like, you know, obviously our society's not perfect. Our society's not a MLS. But if it could be, and we still had that exploitation, what would we do with it, and how would we succeed? But like, I think the mastery of a MLS is it's a dystopia in the sense of, but not in the sense of like, oh well, the problem is very simple. Like, it understands that the society has to be fundamentally taken apart. It understands that there has to be people who walk away. And there's the question of, okay, well, where are the people who are walking away going? And the author of this, you know, presumably doesn't know, but presumably they're going somewhere. They seem to know where they're headed. Right. And that's an important point as well.
Right. You know, once, you know, Kurt's point in the article, not to, you know, not to spoil it, of course, go read it and dissect it. But the response pieces that he discusses to the ones who walk away from Amelis, they miss the point in that they resolve that irreconcilable contradiction, or at least they allude to some sort of resolution that is only vaguely ambiguously implied might or might not be the case, right? Because that's the thing, like, this story is about irreconcilable contradictions, and it's about people who choose to strike out on another path despite that irreconcilability, right? You know, they walk away, you know, they know where they're going, quote unquote, not because they recuse themselves from the situation, as you know, Vivier might say, you know, not because they know what they're building and how they're going to get there, but because they know it has to be better.
Yeah, see, there are like and it's not a Vivier exclusive problem. There are a lot of people who read this story as the ones who walk away being privileged.
Yes.
And that might be the case if it was, I don't know, liberals saying I'm leaving America because Donald Trump got elected. But this isn't a one-to-one comparison here. There were a lot of, and will be again, a lot of privileged liberals being like, I'm leaving because Trump got elected and whatever. And that makes me, no, fuck you. Stay here and fight. But that's not what this story is about, because this is about a complete departure from everything Amelis is. Mm-hmm. It's not Amelis is not geographically defined in this story. And it's also a question of like, is there something beyond Amelis? You know, mm-hmm. Are they walking out into the darkness and basically like stepping off the map and falling and you know, here there be dragons? Like, I don't know.
I like to imagine, and this is neither here nor there, but there's a certain pleasant haziness, right, that suffuses the atmosphere of Amelis here. It kind of reminds me of Lovecraft when he's at his best, which is when he's ripping off Dunsany, right?
Yeah.
The cities in his dream cycle are all like this. It's always sunset. The air's full of music and exotic scents. It's all very, very pretty. Amelis could be right across the sea from Salafeus, right? But again, you know, the idea of a larger world beyond Omelis, of course, you know, I mean, Le Guin talks about landforms here and there, right? But we are forced to assume, I mean, we're forced to look at Omelis in total isolation from anything else, which of course implies that it is also siloed off from whatever these people choose to build. You know, it is fundamentally powerless to do anything except continue to provide the the, what's the word that I'm looking for? You know, to continue to provide the insipid utopia for its people who don't suffer.
Right. Oh man. Well, you know, Le Guin said in the republishing of this that this story has, I won't get the quote exactly right, but long been used by teachers to upset students and make them argue fiercely. And that's also true. You know, I can imagine this would be an interesting in a classroom context. You know, it's a great way of talking about something like utilitarianism. But
you know what that reminds me of, like, in my, I remember this very vividly, in my AP World History class in ninth grade, we read this like short story that was, it presented itself as like, oh, like there's this indigenous people called the Nasarima, which of course is American spelled backwards. Uh-huh. And it did that like, it did that like kind of a gotcha thing where it describes various cultural practices and just like yeah. everyday things as, you know, as out of context as possible. Like, oh, you know,
they people... worship a resurrected god and they pretend exactly. to eat his blood.
You know, people,
yeah.
People go somewhere and they get like cut open and stuff, and you know, which is of course like a surgery and whatnot. Like, and it's a very there's not a lot of depth to it, to my mind. You know, it's supposed to sort of alienate you from what you know about your own society, but there's not really a larger sort of there's not a lot other than the thought experiment to it, to my mind.
Mm-hmm. So the question is, when will the Amelis cinematic universe drop? When will we have, you know, a whole saga of stories set in Amelis? Amelis. No,
y'all barely know us.
Like 5 out of 10. I you know, I'm imagining now as we sit here, you could have like a fun one-shot D&D campaign. The people who walked away from Amelis are like, we're gonna do a job to spring that kid from the base.
Legit, like I would love to play in a D&D one-shot, right, where the whole city rests on some like horrific linchpin, right, and what mm-hmm. happens when that's kind of kicked out of alignment. Mm-hmm. That'd be dope. But what would be even more dope is organizing a better version of Amelis, one that doesn't have a kid suffering as a prerequisite for all its prosperity.
Probably doesn't have so much prostitution either. yeah, neither here nor there. No, I'm kidding.
Only fans Melis? I don't know.
Only fans Melis.
Let's not pursue that.
Yeah. No, of course the prostitution is not the point of her story. I it's funny because the way she sets up the part about it being like really good is it's like supposed to be, you can't really criticize whatever she's gonna say. Like, she'll have an answer to it. Like, no, it is good, no matter how you see good. So it would be very annoying to get into that. Well, that sounds exploited. Yeah, no, like no, that's not.
She kind of laughs at herself a bit on this page here. Like, if so, please add an orgy. Let us not, however, have temples from which issue beautiful nude priests and priestesses already half in ecstasy and ready to copulate with any man or woman, lover or stranger, who desires union with the deep godhead of the blood. Although that was my first idea.
She was like, indeed.
It's a very easy thing, to my mind, to kind of default to without really interrogating what has to go into it.
Oh, no doubt. I was just being an ass.
I think that's exactly where she was going with it.
Absolutely. It's also worth noting that, like, there is a and we'll probably talk about this more when we talk about The Dispossessed, but her book of that, which is of this is, you know, it's not dystopian, but like closer, it's kind of dystopian, sort of, because it's talking about a utopia that's flawed. The Dispossessed is about a flawed utopia, like a fundamentally flawed utopia that like should still be defended and upheld, in her view. That's essentially what The Dispossessed is about. It's about like, hey, we've built a society. It's not perfect, but we're working as hard as we can to make it perfect, and we should defend it. So like, it's actually, I think there was some interesting parallels between that and this, but I guess in the dispossessed, it's a society that can continue to be improved and worked on. And Amelis is this way. It is fixed. It is not, you know, the other book is the other one is a book, and it's a richer, wider world. This is essentially a thought experiment. Like I said, it's essentially can be drawn as a graph, a trolley problem.
It's a thought experiment. And also, you know, I mean, what lends it its value beyond that of a thought experiment is that it's a call to action. You know? And again, it's not a specific call to action because it's
hashtag walk away.
That is something entirely different, unfortunately. But yes,
wait, hashtag walk away. Is that something?
As I understand it, hashtag walk away was like some kind of right wing grift thing, like encouraging people, I think black voters specifically, to walk away from the Democratic Party and try to work with the Republicans.
Wait a second. 2018. It's encouraging people to. Yep, it sure did. And guess what? Guess who it was astroturfed by? A court. It looks like Koch brother money. Fun.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, and of course, like, you know, such a project, of course, the limitation of such a project, of course, besides the fact that, you know, why are you telling people to vote for Republicans, is Democrats aren't much better.
Well, the group's founder, Brandon Straka, a hairstylist, was charged and convicted of participating in the Capitol riots. That fucking rules. Anyway, sorry, but I distracted from your point. What were you saying?
What was I saying?
Something about walking away and a call to action.
Oh yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, part of what lends the story its timelessness, I mean, we're still discussing it 50 years hence, is that it acknowledges that you don't know what the struggle is going to look like. You don't know the process of building this Omelis 2.0 that's better. You know, all you can start out with fundamentally is the perception that something is deeply, deeply wrong, as Le Guin herself alludes to in the text, right? The perception that something is deeply, deeply wrong, which fosters the desire and the discipline to study and organize and to, you know, get out in the world and walk and bring people along to walk with you.
No doubt. Well, Joss, this has definitely been on the shorter side, but I do think that we are winding down here a little bit. But of course, this story is on the shorter side as well. Reader, if you have extra time left over because you were going to listen to the rest of this podcast and it's not as long as a normal episode, then you really now have no excuse not to read the story, because I know some of you listen to this episode without reading the story. I'm calling you out. I'm calling you out. Imagine your name here, calling you out personally. So you should go back. You should Google One's Walk Away from Amelis, and you should read it, because it is good. And we have now allotted you free reading time, as my teachers once did in class. They were like, I'm giving you the rest of the period to do homework, but you better work on your homework. We're giving you the rest of the period to do homework. We're giving you the rest of the period to read.
Yes, because this will be on the test. We will find you and we will administer it.
Yes, we will. We will put you in the basement. putting him in the basement with the mops if he's bad. Here's a question. What do you think happens to the kid, like, when the kid's not a kid anymore? Do you think people stop feeling so bad about it? They're just like, that's just the guy we keep in the basement.
I wonder if, like, the kid becomes like a minor celebrity, right? Like, he grows up. Sick. He grows up and then
they let him out.
Basement. Yeah, they let him out and they swap him out. Like, they swap another kid in, and he talks about his experience and how he's just like, you know, I mean, presumably he is just like irreversibly scarred from the isolation and the deprivation and the torture and the starvation and whatnot. But if he isn't, right, I imagine he's very heavily stage managed, like, oh yeah, you know, this suffering was ultimately like, it gave me this perspective on this, that, and the other, you know, something that's very, very compatible with
if this was like a full novel and it was like a fully developed, like, and it shouldn't be, to be clear, but if it was a fully developed thing with like, they would like reveal that the city prostitutes are all former children from the cellar that were like given plastic surgery or something. And now they're manic.
I mean, that's closer to the nature of large swaths of the sex trade than.
No, that's actually true. Yeah, that's closer. Yeah, no, like that is what it would be like if this was more in depth. But, you know, I take a hard, I'm a, I've been on a hard anti-world building kick recently on this pod, and I will continue. I love world building. I just
Are
don't love
you
when people demand it for no reason.
against building worlds in the first place, or are you in favor of destroying worlds?
I'm in favor of destroying worlds in a symbolic sense, like walking away from the world, thus destroying it, or killing the last living dog, thereby destroying the natural world. I'm
Really?
kind of
Well,
on that kind of kick recently.
the kick I'm on is don't build any world to begin with. You know, just center it entirely on the individual. Like, I am a hardcore solipsist.
Okay, that's a good idea. And if the child was a hardcore solipsist, then the entire world would be hell. So,
See?
you know.
See? Maybe. How do we know he's not a hardcore
Yeah,
solipsist,
no, this
right?
kid sucks. We're going back to we're like this kid is selfish. This kid is scared of mops. Fucking dumbass kid. What's scary about a mop? Seriously. This kid's
I'm
like, I'll
just
be good.
saying. I'm
This kid
just
said,
saying.
I'll be good. Like that's why he got thrown in here. Dumbass kid doesn't know anything.
If you're scared of mops, you know, maybe you shouldn't be out in the world.
Right, like maybe like you know, the kid's gonna go out, he's gonna see a horse. If he's scared of a mop, is he gonna be, of course he's gonna be scared of a horse. Okay, so this has been you know, a Melis right-wing radio. I like that right-wing of a Melis radio just has a segment every week be like, and fuck
Just, you know,
the
Tucker
kid.
Carlson comes on and he's like, how do we know that the kid is not, in fact, happy?
Yeah, it's true. One must imagine the
The
bucket child happy.
bucket child. Oh,
Oh man.
dear. Oh, dear.
Folks, we've told a lot of jokes today, but there is nothing funny about bucket children.
Fuck you. I think they're hilarious.
Oh my God. All righty. Well, if there's nothing else, I guess the last thing I'll say is we are going to have, unless like I come through with like a magical guest, probably gonna have a break next week
Yes.
for the holidays.
Yes. Those who are paying attention to the news are no doubt aware that Venezuela and Guyana recently have agreed to resolve the dispute over the Essequibo peacefully without force of arms, which to my mind is a perfect opportunity for me to go down there and conquer it myself and rename it to the Jossequibo.
How does this tie into the mammothification surgery?
Well, see, that's the thing. Like,
Deep lore.
it'll be a
That's
mammoth.
before like half, at least half of our listeners started listening, was the mammothification arc.
Go back and listen to Jurassic Park
The
and
Jurassic Park
get
episode.
a little bit more clarity. But yes, the Essequibo will be a socialist mammoth colony in our lifetime.
Thank God. Thank God. Well, I believe then our next work, and this will give you a little time to read it, will be Red Plenty, a book neither of us have read. I'm looking forward to that. Red Plenty by Francis Spufford. I've been told it is controversial among socialists and communists. Literally going into it with almost no knowledge. We're gonna find out what we think of this one.
Yeah,
I'm
and
excited.
y'all will have read plenty of time.
You'll
Or
have
plenty of time to have read it.
Bucket Child. Okay, everybody. Have a good one.
Merry Christmas.
Listening to Socialist Shelf Radio.